Everything you experience is through one or more of your senses. If you're listening to me right now, you're certainly using your sense of hearing. But you're probably also looking at something, and likely you can feel the floor or seat or the clothes that are on you. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today we're going to learn what the sensory experiences were of the people who lived through the Civil War. It's a topic of a really fascinating book. It's called The Smell of Battle, The Taste of Siege, A Sensory History of the Civil War. Mark Smith is the author. He's the Carolina Distinguished Professor of History at the University of South Carolina and the author of, or editor of, at least a dozen books at least. Mark Smith, welcome to the Ideas Network. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry. My pleasure entirely.
I tell you what, the U.S. Civil War has been written about and chronicled from just about every conceivable angle. But I think this is the first book that approaches it from the five senses. Is that correct?
I think it is, at least in an explicit fashion. I mean, you have to bear in mind that some of the sort of the great tomes or narratives of the Civil War, especially by people like Shelby Foote, invoked the sensory experience of soldiers and civilians, but in a more literary fashion. So there wasn't a whole lot of research that went into, say, his claims that something smelled at a particular battle. It was used as a kind of literary device.
And, yeah.
And my intention in this book was to kind of document not just those claims, but expand the remit so that we're talking about the sensory experience of people who fought this war, who experienced this war in all sensory capacities. So in that sense, you're right. It is the first explicit and sustained treatment of the Civil War from a sensory perspective.
Yeah, and this obviously is an area that fascinates you. You've approached other topics through the senses as well, if I'm not mistaken.
I have, you know, I mean, this has been an ongoing project for many years. I'm a general editor of a series in studies in sensory history at the University of Illinois Press, and we produce books on the senses, sensory history, and I've written on the sensory history of 19th century America and the coming of the Civil War, the sensory history of the South, of the construction of racial identity and stereotypes. A good deal of stuff on sound. That's how I pretty much started off.
Yeah.
Sort of listening to the past and then kind of migrating into the other senses.
You make a very interesting point that all of the senses would have been different 150 years ago in the sense that what people then were accustomed to would have been very different in general terms. Maybe talk a little bit about what those differences are between then and now.
Well, that's actually probably the sort of central historical question.
Yeah.
Kind of quite a question about knowing and experiencing, right? So I'm very glad that you brought that up. So it is my contention that a good deal of the sensory experience of people in, say, 1863 cannot be exported in a kind of experiential fashion to us now. And there are lots of reasons for that. You know, you can't recreate Gettysburg, neither should you want to, in the sense that this was such a slaughter of human bodies that the technology of death outpaced the technology of burial, and in July 1863 those bodies were left baking on the fields. They couldn't bury them fast enough, and this created a stench and a smellscape that was so overpowering that it lasted for weeks, arguably months. Now you can't recreate that. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, and so you can recreate parts of Gettysburg, but for me, that battle was about the stench of death, the kind of fetor of decivilization. Now, even if you could recreate it, Larry, let's imagine certain sensory experiences of the past that you could recreate. The past is, you know, things have happened between then and now, so we live in a very deodorized age. We live in a refrigerated age. We live in a world in which there are new smells and new protocols governing what smells, what is defined as stench or a good smell. And so history has moved on so that our reference points are very, very different, and we wouldn't perhaps understand what somebody said stank in 1863 in the same way. But what we can do, is we can take the contemporaries at their word. We have to always be very careful about what people are saying. Obviously, this is the job of the historian. But we can understand what experience was to them. So when we have a Civil War nurse going to Gettysburg, and she talks about the thickness of the stench, the smell of death, so thick, laden, that it was overpowering, we can take that as a legitimate commentary on what Gettysburg meant to her and to other people. And, of course, you know, we pattern these things to find out what the signature of that battle was. But I think that applies to historical consciousness generally. We have to be very careful about trying to recreate the past in an effort to experience it. I'm not saying that it's impossible, but sensorially, it is fraught with danger and difficulty.
Yeah, I was thinking back. I unfortunately had the occasion to smell the death of someone who had been, people who had been dead for several days in warm conditions. So I have some idea of what that smell is like, and it's awful. You mentioned the nurse. Cornelia Hancock is who you write about.
Yes.
And she was... who was she? Who was Cornelia?
She was a very young lady from New Jersey, and she decided that she wanted to go and tend to the wounded at Gettysburg, to be involved in the war in some capacity. And so she ended up going to Gettysburg a few days after the end of the battle. And she was extraordinarily descriptive in her diary journals. And, you know, she wasn't the only one, and I was very careful not to sort of lay too much interpretive weight on just one person. But I use her as the kind of nose that guides us through Gettysburg. And she gets there, and the thing that hits her first is not just the visual mangled sea of bodies through which she has to tiptoe, but the stench that is a product of that scale of death. And, you know, I use other people too, people who lived in Gettysburg, the residents, and they say the same thing, and even the soldiers are saying the same thing. So we can have a sort of reliable portrait of what Gettysburg was to them, and it was overwhelmingly an olfactory event. And it's undocumented, but, you know, people do say, well, of course, you know, Lincoln could smell the death, the mild lingering scent of death at the Gettysburg Address. And whether or not that's true, I don't know. There's no sort of real documentation to back it up. But nonetheless, I think it's suggestive that it's come passed down in law, in a way, to describe the scale and the nature of this. And I suppose what I'm trying to say, Larry, is, you know, the Gettysburg was in many ways a kind of noble moment in the Civil War. I mean, it inspired one of the greatest speeches in American history. It was a turning point in many ways. And I don't think we should lose sight of that nobility and those grand gestures. But what I'm trying to do is remember and excavate the gritty experience that led to those grand gestures. What did it mean to experience war? What allowed these grand gestures of nationalism and emancipation to flourish? And it was the experience on the ground. And I'm not the first person to talk about that experience. I mean, many people have done really quite remarkable jobs of that. But what I'm trying to do is get to the kind of viscerality of war, the experience of war. And smell is certainly one of those things. Because smell is insistent. You have no nose lids. Just to breathe, just to be there in that sea of bodies, to exist, you have to inhale.
Yeah, you can't get away from it. You can't get away from it.
You can't. And that's why it's such a powerful memory trigger as well. Smell is transgressive. It will go through you. You have to smell. You have to inhale. And that's what triggers memory, too.
It's something I certainly will never forget, that smell. Mark Smith, our guest today, a Carolina Distinguished Professor of History at the University of South Carolina and author and editor of a dozen books, including Sensing the Past, Seeing, Hearing, Smelling, Tasting, and Touching in History, and how Race is Made, Slavery, the Census, and Segregation. His most recent book is The Smell of Battle, The Taste of Siege, A Sensory history of the Civil War. I invite you to join in, too. Have you ever thought about the sights, the smells, the tastes of the Civil War, what they were for the people of that time? Mark Smith, happy to talk with you about what he's learned today. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post your questions or your comments there. We'd certainly love to hear from you. I want to talk a little bit about the sense of taste that is one that people might not think of in terms of war as much, but you really, talk about visceral, you really paint a very vivid picture with Vicksburg as the backdrop. Talk about that city before the, you know, the war, or
I do think that this before and after and slash during issue is very important. So, you know, you can't just sort of jump straight into the war and explore the sensory context of the war without knowing something about what conditions were like before the war. So with Vicksburg, the great siege, almost 50-day siege at Vicksburg, Mississippi, a siege, by definition, at some level, is about taste, because it's about reducing a population, civilian and military, to a level of starvation. And to understand the implications of that, you have to be very context-specific. So here we have Vicksburg. It is a slaveholding city. Prior to the Civil War, it's on the Mississippi. It is inundated with foods from around the country. Slaveholders there are eating extremely well. If you look at what they're growing on their plantations, if you look at what they're eating in their restaurants, I mean, these are delicacies. This is gustatory paradise in a way. Now, of course, you know, what one eats is also indexed to one's sense of social standing. So taste is gustatory, but is also an aesthetic. It says something about your taste and your sense of standing and social class. So what these folks were doing was kind of reaffirming their sense of authority through what they ate. And, of course, poor whites and slaves in the city didn't eat as well. And that was part of a much larger stereotype, especially about slaves, you know, what kinds of foods could they taste and what kinds of foods did they need. Enter the siege, right? Enter the siege in the middle of the war. And what we have is a radical denigration of the palate. So that people that were used to fine wines, used to fresh food in abundance, suddenly found themselves reduced to a different kind of diet. And the reduction was so radical, Larry, that we have very powerful former slaveholders, or slaveholders at the time, paying a dollar for a rat. We have children eating their pet birds. We have dogs going missing. We have horses becoming scarce. And this is an atavism. This is a sort of moment of decivilization, because it attacks both the palate but also the sense of aesthetic, also the sense of social standing. So in other words, by the end of this siege, you have slaveholders who are eating like slaves. They're eating at a station much below to which they're accustomed. And, of course, the slaves themselves are even in a worse position, although far more able, I think, to take advantage kind of in a clever fashion of the circumstance, because they were used to getting food on the quiet and illicitly anyway. So this is the kind of taste that I was interested in during the war. And you can find it in other places too. I mean, there are food riots throughout the Confederacy, but nothing quite approaching the level of Vicksburg. And the comparisons, I think, are very clear with other sieges throughout history, in which people feel the same sense of denigration, the same sense of humiliation through the reduction in their diet.
Yeah, it was the morale, and the social fabric of that community was just destroyed.
It is, and that's what they end up talking about what they had assumed to be, you know, sort of always there. So water becomes a terribly important issue. I mean, they take water for granted, obviously, but potable water becomes very scarce by the end of this siege. decent food, freshness. They're now sort of thrown into a world of staleness. And even their noses, and the nose is the sentinel of taste. When you smell, before you taste something, you smell it and make sure that it's okay, that it's not rancid. Well, these folks are smelling things, and the food smells rancid, but they eat them nonetheless because they have no choice. So there's a very sort of powerful reduction, and they start to talk about themselves in non-human terms. They're almost sort of animalistic at some level.
And I think just to wind up that part of it a little bit, at the end there was extreme anger for the Confederate soldier who was in charge because they really weren't out of supplies when the siege ended.
Right, so who's besieging whom here is really the question. So Pemberton was accused of having all sorts of supplies, lots of salt, lots of meat, held in barracks in anticipation of not losing the siege. And so he comes in for it at the end of the war for not having deployed this food. So the besieged, understandably very angry, not just at the Union forces, but also at some of the Confederate.
Talking today with Mark Smith. Mark is author of The Smell of Battle, The Taste of Siege, a sensory history of the Civil War. Take some questions and comments now. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And right now, visiting with Mark Smith about The Smell of Battle, The Taste of Siege, a sensory history of the Civil War. Again, you can join us with your questions at 800-642-1234. I'd love to hear from you. Let's turn to Paul in Washington County. Paul, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. The question I have is, there were several million horses and mules that were employed to, you know, pull armaments and supplies to the front. But when these were animals were either injured, did both the Union and the Confederates have a force or some semi-trained people to address the injuries, or were they summarily shot? And on when these animals were out in the field in the southern heat, would they use quicklime to control the order, or did they bury them? What happened? Talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
Well, that's a very interesting question. The evidence that I came across, I don't know if there's an official sort of Union or Confederate policy on this issue, but the evidence that I came across showed that there wasn't a whole lot of burial going on. If the meat were considered palatable and digestible, then they were eaten. I do think you're actually asking a very interesting question about the larger kind of smellscape of Vicksburg, because you have a sort of no man's land in between the city and parts of the Union forces, in which, you know, lots of Grant's men early on are shot while he's trying to take the city, and those bodies are left for fear of being shot through capturing them and taking them back. And so at the beginning of that siege, it reeks of death, just like Gettysburg does. And some of that, of course, was the smell of horses, too, and the smell of mules. And in actual fact, let me just take it back to Gettysburg. We have 2,000 horses and mules on the fields, and that's part of the smellscape, the baking of those dead animals. So it's not just human death, it's a kind of death beyond humanity, including animals. So it's thoroughgoing, I suppose, is my point. And it doesn't really matter if you're in Vicksburg or Gettysburg, those kinds of scents are swirling and migrating and infecting everybody's noses, if that answers your question.
Yes, thank you very much for that question. Let's turn to Chuck in Eau Claire next. Chuck, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Hi, Larry. Thanks for the program. Your guest is very, very interesting. I have done Civil War presentations in the northern part of the state here for many, many years. And I try to get the people to understand about the average soldier and what they're experiencing. And what I do with the smell of death, obviously most people have not experienced that, is I will say, you know, if you've had a mouse or some other critter who has died in the house, and you smell that sweet, pungent smell, that will give you an idea. And then also, if a person were to see a recent deer kill on the highway, with those sights and what you see, is to multiply that by 1,000, and that will give some understanding to the average person as to what it must have been like to go through a Vicksburg or a Gettysburg or an Antietam or what have you.
Very interesting, Mark. And you talk a bit about not necessarily presentations like Chuck has done, but about reenactors. And you have a lot of respect for people like Chuck and also for reenactors. But it really is difficult, isn't it, to convey the proper senses of the time.
It is. And I think, you know, Chuck and I are trying to do the same thing in different ways. And I think, you know, these are what we're trying to convey. Is that essential experience of war for lots of people, not just the average soldier, but civilians too, as well as, you know, officers. But it's extremely difficult, and Chuck's right. So he's choosing examples that are suggestive and gestural, right? And then, you know, you use the multiplier effect. So you say, look, you know, here's the smell of a dead rodent. Now imagine this multiplied by several thousand humans in a very hot environment, a baking environment. And now imagine this in the context of not being able to bury them. And you're sort of getting towards some idea of what it must have been like. But here I'm going to make a pitch for the power of the written word. So the written word, the words of the people at the time, can often convey with an unusual precision just how powerful that was to them. And if it's powerful to them, it should remain powerful with us. Okay, so I think that looking at diaries and reading letters can really kind of give you that sense of depth and texture of the past. In addition to the kind of thing that Chuck's up to, I mean, I think that this idea of the sight of blood is actually very powerful too. You know, people tend not to see a whole lot of blood unless they are in the active military or law enforcement or they're doctors. But the average person doesn't. Well, you know, lots of these soldiers were average people. I mean, lots of them hadn't fought before. And one of the sights that they comment on is not just, you know, blood, but the sheer volume of the stuff. You know, it's baking, it's turning fields red. And so context matters. You know, context of what did it mean to smell in 1863 matters a great deal. But also somehow we have to make this understandable to people in the present without making it an easy comparison. Because I think, you know, you have to work hard at the historical context. And I think an easy answer is often a misleading answer. So I think Chuck's on the right track here. And I think, you know, if you read my book and listen to Chuck, you're probably getting somewhere towards what it must have been like, right?
Yeah. Mark, could I just put one more thing in, please?
Sure.
Had the good and great opportunity to interview a student at Gettysburg College a couple of years ago. And she talked about the fact that in the October and November after the July incident, that people would put a balm under their nose to help mask the smell, and they would also, because the water in the Gettysburg Valley was either contaminated or the wells were dry, that they would send 8 to 10 wagons, water wagons, to Chambersburg because that was a different water supply, and bring it back in. And then she said, and not only that, there was a great, great blue fly infestation that came in because of the carnage, especially the horses and so on, and mules. And that added to the misery of the people, that not only the smell and the lack of water, but you have these tens of thousands of blue flies infesting the area. So it kind of gives a little more idea that it wasn't just a battle and then people went on with the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
I think that's an excellent point. And I think the point there is that the Battle of Gettysburg is two things. It lasts a few days, but it also lasts weeks in a way. You can't forget it because it's an insistent repetition of the smell. And I think that those kinds of details, and I have lots of people, you know, in the book who are using handkerchiefs and various methods to stifle the smell or deflect it, and then they start to remember that smell of perfume to be associated with battle too, so you can't really escape it eventually.
Yeah, interesting. Chuck, thanks a lot for calling.
You bet. Thank you much. Yeah,
appreciate the call. You can join in as well at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. I think one of the another of the very interesting discussions I think you have in the book is with the sense of touch, the experience of the sailors inside a Confederate submarine. And I really found it fascinating, your discussion kind of before, or you got into the discussion of the Confederate submarine Hundley, that you talked about personal space and touch of people at the time.
Yeah, so the H.O. Hundley submarine was a very interesting and very difficult thing to do research on, because the eight men aboard that submarine, while they achieved their objective of sinking the USS Housatonic in 1864 in Charleston Harbor, they died in the process. So the submarine sank to the bottom of Charleston Harbor, then was sort of rescued, you know, in the year 2000, and now it's on display, and scientists are sort of chiseling away and trying to find out exactly what happened. So I used the Hundley as an illustration of tactility, and here you have this incredibly small space. I mean, the H.L. Hundley was a very, very small submarine that was hand-powered with a crankshaft going almost down the middle. And these men were charged with powering this submarine to ram in a torpedo that was attached to a long arm at the front of the submarine. And if you look at this submarine, and these men weren't small. I mean, one was over 6 foot. They're stooped, and their fingers are sort of grazed by the metal and the wood, and their skin is kind of shown contempt through the sheer effort to power this submarine through the water. And this was completely in contradiction to the tactile protocols and sense of space of white men in the antebellum period. You know, there were sort of protocols about touching and shaking hands and personal space, but white men were very rarely confined in this kind of tight, haptic, tactile space, the constant rubbing. And the nearest comparisons that were available to at the time were perhaps some miners, you know, people who worked in mines, but largely the enslaved. Yeah. So here you have this really sort of powerful parallel between these willing men of the Confederacy going into this submarine and a kind of, you know, experience of the enslaved, at least in a tactile way. And I don't want to overdraw the comparison here, because obviously one was a voluntary exercise and the other one wasn't. But nonetheless, it shows you the depth to which people were committed to this enterprise, that they were willing to suspend these protocols and behave in ways that treated their own skin with utter contempt.
It was absolutely amazing. The description that you have in there of how they work together in the size of that space within that submarine, and you know, you almost had to know you were likely not to come out of that alive.
Well, I think that's right, because you know that submarine had sunk twice on exploratory sort of test expeditions beforehand, and in one of those instances I think everybody died on board. So I think there was the residual smell of death, perhaps, although they tried whitewashing the inside and cleaning it out and what have you. But there was the sense of, you know, this is a highly dangerous gambit, and you are, if you sank, you were unlikely to come out. Now, what had happened before is that they had sunk before, and they did manage to get out of it by sort of reversing their propeller. But nonetheless, it had a sort of sarcophagal feel. This is, you know, an extraordinarily closed environment. I think probably the nearest comparison I can think in terms of warfare would be sort of First World War tanks. You know, these are extremely closed environments. And the idea that, you know, if you're hit or you make a mistake, you're probably not going to get out of this. And, of course, they didn't, did they? And when that submarine was brought to the surface, you know, in the year 2000, they found each man at his station. And so at the very point of death, they weren't touching other humans. They were sort of isolated in their space. And they were only touched by human hands, you know, what, 140 odd years later, when they were resurrected, when they were brought to the surface. It's a very poignant story, and a very sort of, it was a very difficult thing to write because not one of them could leave any written records. So you have to sort of talk to the marine archaeologists about what they were wearing and what positions they were in, and nobody really knows why the Hundley sunk. Nobody really knows, you know, whether or not the sailors were concussed through the explosion. I mean, those answers are probably going to take many years to uncover. But what I was trying to get to is the experience of submariners. And it's not a commonly told story during the Civil War. We tend to focus on the field, on land. And I thought to give a sense of the scope of this war, it was wise to include some maritime history too.
Yeah, and it's, and I mean, it's not those, not only hand powered, but then, you know, getting oxygen in and being able to see anything, it must have been just an awful experience. But yeah, it was one that was, I think, as you point out, it was a privilege reserved for white men.
Yeah, some of these folks, you know, I try to, just sort of knowing their history of each man is quite difficult, but some of them were, you know, fairly elite, at least Dixon, who was the commander of the submarine. Now, he wasn't powering the sub. I mean, the sense of sight and sound that they used for him, because he was tweaking levers and directing the submarine. Some of the other folks powering the submarine were of rather more modest means. But nonetheless, you know, there was this sense of dignity attached to this and this sense of privilege. You know, it's this was cutting edge technology for the time. And, you know, from their perspective, to their credit, they brought down a state of the art union warship. I mean, the USS Housatonic was no small feat. And they managed to dispatch it.
And they changed actually how the Union worked with its ships afterwards, as you point out.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Union was aware of these. You have to bear in mind, submarines at the time, and in fact since, at least in the 20th century, were considered to be sneaky and lacking honor because you couldn't see them, right? So the idea that you couldn't see your enemy was somehow a subterfuge. And so the Union forces were quite, they sort of condemned the use of these things. But nonetheless, after the Housatonic and before, they were thinking of ways to avoid having to deal with them and perhaps embrace submarine warfare themselves.
Bill in Deerfield, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, this is a really, really fascinating conversation. My family is from Southern Virginia, the Petersburg area. There were battles everywhere, all around my family's property. And just with all due respect, the whole idea of the reenactment on a sensory level, nobody in my family is in favor of these reenactors because they don't have any idea of what the real sensory situation was. Like, whenever I see a reenactor, a Confederate Civil War reenactor, I say, why are you wearing shoes? For much of the war, Confederate soldiers didn't have shoes. In fact, they were going to Gettysburg, and one reason was to get some shoes. And why is your uniform so nice? You know, why did you brush your teeth in the last 6 months? it's a completely false reality from what was really going on.
Comment from you, Mark.
Well, I agree entirely. I think that's actually very well put. The introduction to the book is sort of dedicated to a brief conversation about can we reenact the past? And, you know, I say you can't. You can't for the very reasons that you gave. And moreover, I'm probably not sure that it's always desirable to do that. Look, there's a reason why Gettysburg is reenacted, but not the H.L. Hunley sinking. Right? There's a reason why First Bull Run is reenacted, but not Vicksburg. Right, because these are not pleasant things to reenact, and they don't have the same kind of feel for people. Having said that, you know, and I'm not having a go at the reenactors on this. What I'm trying to say is, if you want to reenact, of course, you know, that's your right. But perhaps reading about the experience of people in the past who experienced the thing that you're about to reenact is actually a quite helpful experience. For getting a kind of a reorientation about what is possible to re-experience and what's not. It seems to me that most reenactors aren't trying to reenact exactly the experience of the past. Although, you know, undoubtedly some of them are trying to do that. But in that process, I would just caution that we do this with museums all the time, don't we? Lots of museums use sensory devices to help us re-engage with the past. And I think as long as we're saying this is gestural and not definitive, that's fine. I think the danger comes when you're saying, hey, this is the smell of the past, this is the taste of the past, because it really can't be that. It can only vaguely approximate that past and never duplicate it. So if you go to these various living museums, and some of them are better than others, you know, Jorvik in England is a Viking village, it's a recreation. The most popular part of that for visitors is the Viking latrine, in which you are given a scratch and sniff card as you go in to experience the smell of a Viking latrine. Well, of course, you're not experiencing that, but you're... What you're doing is you're kind of engaging in a conceit, right? Oh, well, this stinks. This must be the past. The past always smells. But I wonder if it did smell with the same meaning to the Viking himself. And I'm not sure that it did, because the technology of the age was so different. You know, food smelled differently. Even the availability of food at certain times alters how we taste things. So I think that your call is entirely right. But at the same point in time, I think that we're all engaged in a sort of larger educational purpose, and I think opening up that conversation is actually a very helpful thing. So I think that folks who reenact can actually, they know a great deal about the material culture of soldiering, which I found to be very useful. It's just that we perhaps might have different interpretations about how to use that material culture and what it means.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. Mark, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. There is plenty more that we haven't discussed that I would love to talk with you about, but I really appreciate it. I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. I enjoyed it.
Appreciate it very much. Mark Smith, Carolina Distinguished Professor of History at the University of South Carolina. I hope you have a chance to look at his book. It's called The Smell of Battle, The Taste of Siege, Sensory History of the Civil War. Really different. And you know, I don't know how many books I've read on the Civil War, maybe 100. And this was certainly a different look for me at the events of the time in the Civil War. Well, as we just heard, there's no way that modern people can experience or convey the reality on the ground during the Civil War. But well-researched reenactments can still bring history to life. Coming up after just a short break, we're going to talk with two Wisconsin Civil War reenactors. We'll find out what characters they portray and how they do their research. So I hope you will stay tuned. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, talking with two members of the Muskets and Memories Civil War Era Reenactment Committee. Mary Leifheit is one of our guests today. She started painting miniatures and sewing costumes that led to becoming a member of the Muskets and Memories Civil War Era Reenactment Committee. She's taken a role on roles as a civilian Civil War reenactor. as Elizabeth Van Loo, I believe, and then as a Civil War military reenactor with an artillery unit. Marie, welcome.
Thank you for having us, Larry.
Oh, it's great to have you here. Keegan Campbell, a sophomore at Fenimore High School, who's been reenacting for 6 years already. He first got started, I think through his grandmother. He portrays a cavalryman and an artilleryman as part of the 9th Virginia Cavalry and McGregor's Battery. So he is in Southern dress and does about 8 events a year and has even attended the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg Civil War reenactment. And there were like 15,000 reenactors. I wish I could have been there for that. Keegan, good to have you with us. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry.
So you were about 10 years old, right, when you got started?
Yep.
Tell us that, sir. How did that happen?
Well, my brother and my sister had been reenacting, and my grandma asked me if I wanted to try it, and I said yes and got hooked the first day of it.
And you've been doing it ever since, and do about 80 a year?
Yep.
Well, and Mary, you've been involved for longer than that.
Yeah, about 22 years.
Yeah.
22 years.
Mary, what's the purpose of historical reenactment?
Our reenactment is basically educational, and it's also to honor the veterans and the events that happened before us to make America the country that it is today.
Yeah. You play two very different roles. Tell us about those roles.
Well, which two?
Well, you were playing... who was the woman you were playing?
Elizabeth Van Loo.
Yeah, Elizabeth Van Loo.
Do I have a moment for just a quick story about that one?
Sure.
Okay. We were doing a program in one of the schools in Iowa, and they wanted a hooker.
Ah!
Or a fallen woman.
Yeah.
And I had a lady all lined up. It was a middle school, and this is the age of interest in that sort of thing, I guess. And at the week before, the lady called me and says, "Oh my gosh, Marie, I can't do this." Well, I didn't really know any people like that. So they still wanted something very interesting. So I did some very quick, more in-depth research, and I came up with Elizabeth Van Loo, who was a spy for the Union and lived in Richmond, Virginia, if you can imagine.
Yeah.
Now, she was branded Crazy Bet because anybody living in Richmond surely was not an abolitionist. So she took the Crazy Bet a few steps farther, and she portrayed a crazy person. Her family had been very wealthy, so she was allowed into the circles of the Confederate officers and just kind of eavesdropped, and that's how she started. And her story is just absolutely fascinating. Her name is Elizabeth, V-A-N-L-E-W, if you want to look it up. Mm-hmm. It's just a very fun character to portray.
Oh, it must have been a lot of fun. I know I interviewed Jennifer Cheverini a while ago. I don't know if you know Jennifer or of her
book. Not personally, but I've read her books, yes.
Yeah, and she has a very interesting book about that very character,
yeah.
that very person, I shouldn't say character, that was a lot of fun to talk with her about. So you, how do you research your roles then? You said you'd quickly researched, but...
Well, when I started, the internet was not as available as it is now because it was 22 years ago, and I didn't even know how to work a computer. And I'm still learning. But the computer is quite advantageous to our hobby. Getting together with other reenactors is, we're not only reenactors, we're educators. And we're just more than willing to share every tidbit of information and knowledge that we have.
I want to mention, as you listen to us talking here, as I talk with Marie and Keegan, I hope you'll go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, because probably by this time, Judith Sears-Poisson has posted a photo of the two of them, and they're posing in their, or they came today, we asked them to come today in their costumes, which probably when you're walking around the University of Wisconsin campus in those costumes, you might have gotten a second look or two.
No, we got dressed here.
Oh, you did it here.
Oh,
ah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, that's a wonderful picture of the two of them. So I hope, as you listen today, I hope you'll take a look at that picture on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. The other role you play was an artillery?
I'm a certified gunner, but not terribly active. I mean, the guys really don't want me giving orders. I just basically did it so I could have the experience of what a reenactor experiences, because I'm basically an organizer and a civilian reenactor.
Well, now, Keegan, you tell us about your role.
I play one of two roles at each reenactment. I can either do artilleryman or cavalryman.
And how did you research that? I mean, you had to learn how they actually operated, I assume.
I use numerous magazines and books, and the biggest way I research it is by walking up to other reenactors and asking them, hey, is this authentic, or what did they used to do back then?
And go from there. And is there acting involved in this, or how does it feel when you're out there?
There's a lot of acting involved. It's basically like a gigantic stage, the field is.
Yeah. And Marie, how does it all get planned? I mean, there may be particular battles that you're reenacting, and you know the results, but still, that takes organization and a whole lot of planning, I would think.
Well, most Civil War era reenactments are much more than just the battles. Just about every event has a different battle on Saturday than on Sunday, but we also have a very large civilian contingency, because the civilian life did go on during the Civil War. We have a lot of medical. Now, if you want to see where medical started, basically you come to a reenactment, because we have some phenomenal medical demonstrations immediately after the battles. Very realistic, of course, they aren't, but this is all acting.
Well, I think a lot was learned, frankly, as say, from doctors learned a whole lot.
That's how it is with every war.
You mentioned the battles, or we think about the battles, but there's also a lot of other things depicted in a reenactment. Talk about some more of those and what goes on.
Well, I can talk about the civilians. We have a civilian camp there, and they portray just about every aspect of the civilian life, whether it was farming or beekeeping or candle making, broom making, whatever. We usually have a few period politicians. We don't have any contemporary politicians there, because our event is, say, political. But like I said, we have the medical. We have the cavalry.
So there's a lot extra there. Keegan, for you, is every reenactment event different? Are they, they're focusing on different events, aren't they? Or are the same? You do the same battles most of the time?
It's usually a different battle every reenactment I go to. I mean, after a couple of years, they'll repeat the big ones, but usually every year it's a different battle.
And what was it like to be at Gettysburg? Were you part of the reenactment at Gettysburg, or were you there as an observer?
I was part of the reenactment, and it was pretty astonishing to see how many people gathered just for this event. There was a infantry line of two people thick that was 1 mile wide, marching across the field and going up to assault the Union line. It was pretty amazing.
Pickett's charge, in other words.
Yeah.
I walked that ground when I was at Gettysburg, and it was a moving experience just to walk the ground with one of the park rangers explaining how things went as across that field. It must have been unbelievable to watch it from an observer's point of view, but then also to participate. How did it feel walking across?
It felt awesome. Pretty cool.
Yeah, I would bet. Bonnie in Barron County has a question. Hi, Bonnie. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My question is, as far as your costumes are concerned, how do you find or create authentic costumes using what kind of materials? And the construction, is construction always done in the old-fashioned way, or do you use modern sewing machines?
Okay, first I'll say that the sewing machine was invented, in parentheses, by a woman in 1856. But in 1856, women weren't allowed the privilege of recognition, so her husband invented the sewing machine. Yes. I have to get that in. So, but sewing machines were not very common during the Civil War. They were available, but they were somewhat pricey and not terribly common. So most of the work was done by hand, which of course takes a very long time. I make my own garments, and I use period construction techniques, of which there are numerous resources you can get off the internet. Things like the long seams in the skirts I do by machine. Now, in the 1860s, aniline dyes were just becoming available, and that made the colors more brilliant. Before that, the colors were somewhat subdued. The fabrics were also natural fibers, which were silk, wool, cotton, and linen, or possibly a combination of those.
Very interesting. And Keegan, you've got what looks like an actual Southern military wear that you're wearing there. It looks really pretty real.
Yeah. After a few reenactments, you get dirt on it. I mean, it sinks in and they start to look like they were actually in the Civil
and
War.
And smell.
And look and smell like they were in the Civil War. Well, Marie and Keegan, this has been great. The time flew. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Coming up, we're going to continue our discussion about the Civil War with the author of the notorious Isaac Earle and his Scouts, Union Soldiers, Prisoners, Spies. Coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look today at a book about a bunch of Wisconsin guys who worked during the Civil War, were soldiers, and in particular, Gordon Olson has written a book called The Notorious Isaac Earle and His Scouts, Union Soldiers, Prisoners, and Spies. Gordon Olson, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Pleasure to join you, Larry.
Great to have you along. How did you learn the story of Isaac Earle?
Well, it goes back a long way, longer perhaps than I care to admit. But when I was a graduate student, I did my master's thesis on Isaac Earle and the Scouts, and I did that because my advisor came to me one day and he said, "Have you picked a topic yet?" He knew I hadn't, and I said, "No, of course." And he said, "Well, I got one." He had gotten the memoir of one of the Scouts into the historical collections at the State University at River Falls, now part of the university system. And he said, "This is a story worth telling." So I began research then, got the master's degree, went on, did some other graduate work. But always in the back of my head was, I want to go back, and that story deserves a lot more than a master's thesis. And I kept telling people, and finally my best friend said to me, "If you don't shut up," or basically said, "Shut up and do the book." And I finally did after I retired. So it's 40 years later, but finally the book is out.
Man, am I glad you did. This is a story that we really haven't read about, or at least I haven't read about. And I've read a lot of books about the Civil War, but this is something different.
A few people knew about it. There's a fellow named Mike Martin who did a history of the 4th Wisconsin Cavalry. And Mike included them in his book, of course. But he agreed. He said, you know, they deserve their own book. And I'll tell you how well known they were and still are. I did a program in Natchez, Mississippi last spring when the book first came out. And I looked over an audience of about 50 people, and I got all through and did the standard of any questions. And immediately, two hands went up in the audience. And the first hand I called on the woman, she said, "I'm here tonight because I've been hearing about Isaac Earle, or Isaac Earle has been in my family's history for 150 years, and I wanted to know more about him." It turned out his scouts had raided her family's plantation, and the family still didn't like it very much.
150 years later.
150 years. And the other woman in the audience said the same thing. She said, "Well, he raided my house and disrupted my family and arrested two of the women in the family, and I don't like him." And since I've heard from a third person from the area whose family history includes the Isaac Earle story. So he's known, but this is the first book-length treatment by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, he has obviously Wisconsin connections, and how did he come to enlist?
Well, right at the beginning of the Civil War, the first thing that happened after Fort Sumter was President Lincoln sent out a call for volunteers, and states across the North responded. And in the first group to respond from Wisconsin was the second group, which was just a few weeks later, was the 4th Wisconsin Infantry at that point. And Isaac Earle, who was from the Wisconsin Dells area, a place called Kilbourne City, which is, I think, now Wisconsin Dells, was part of a group called the Columbia Rifles. They've been training a little bit. They volunteered immediately, made their way to Milwaukee, and then on down to Racine, where they trained. They volunteered in, I think it was May, and by July they were in Maryland and engaged in battle.
Yeah, and then he winds up, though, along the Mississippi River.
Exactly. The Union had always had a plan, even before there was war, that one of the keys would be to divide the Confederacy by holding the Mississippi River. And so they set out on that very quickly. It's where ultimately Ulysses Grant made his reputation. But before long, those Wisconsin boys were all put on an ocean-going vessel and taken down into the Gulf of Mexico. In May of 1862, the war has only been going for a year, they successfully were part of the successful invasion up the Mississippi to seize New Orleans, and then they kept going. They continued to fight. Ultimately, Earl really comes to everyone's attention for his courage at a place called Port Hudson in 1863, which was captured the same time that Vicksburg was. And when those two places fell, the Mississippi, as Abraham Lincoln was said at the time, the Mississippi flows unvexed to the sea. And that meant that the Union had control of that great river and its transportation routes, and it had successfully divided the Confederacy.
And Major Canby was the guy? I was trying to remember that.
Major General Canby.
Yeah, Major General Canby, yeah.
Right. Yeah, he was West Point. He had fought in some very interesting places, the Seminole War in Florida. He'd been in Mexico during the Mexican War. He had fought against Navajo in the West. At one point, he was even engaged in a little conflict with the Mormons out in Utah. He understood what we would call irregular and small war, and he's the one who gets the credit for organizing a group of 30 men, finding the best veterans he could, putting them in the command of a known soldier who was a very active and a very spontaneous kind of soldier, and then gave them the very best weaponry he possibly could and said, now, you are to go out there and you're going to be the anti-insurrectionary force. Today we would call them special operations. There's no two ways about it. These are the guys whose job it was to chase after the guerrillas and the outlaws and everyone, keep them away from the river and keep the river open.
And boy, was he successful.
Certainly
30
was.
30 guys, they did a lot of quote-unquote damage to the Confederacy.
They certainly did, and they were on the go constantly. The key was that before long, General Canby issued them their own steamboat, their own crew. And then that opened it up for them. They, as you said in your earlier segment, they went all the way from the White River, which is central Arkansas, all the way down to New Orleans. And they were on the go. They, before the war was over, I think they'd gone through four steamboats. one of their biggest problems always was that they had to take the steamboat in for repairs. They didn't give those steamboats much time to recover. They just used them up.
Well, and, you know, the reason that steamboats were so important was they could be in one part of, along one part of the river, but then they could jump on the steamboat and very quickly go quite a distance.
Absolutely.
And surprise people.
And they absolutely did. They developed one of their major tactics. They were docked most when they were docked, and that's just Mississippi. And they would almost always go out at night. They would slip out on their boat into the river and then head usually upstream from Natchez, and they would black out the windows, do everything they could to run quiet. Oftentimes, then they would run past their destination. St. Joseph, Louisiana, was a primary target. There were a lot of smugglers and a lot of guerrillas around St. Joseph, which is north of Vicksburg, but not too, or of Natchez, but not too far. And then they would dock north of where their destination, unload very quickly, and then ride on horseback, because they had their horses with them all the time on the steamboats, back to where they intended to do their raid. So they snuck up on a lot of people in the course of their history.
Well, and the descriptions of this are wonderful. You have some wonderful descriptions. And, of course, you know, you weren't dreaming these up out of you got this information from letters and all kinds of sources from those who were there.
Right, absolutely. Letters, diaries, official reports. One of the things that General Canby required, well, he did two things. First of all, he said to Lieutenant Earl, "You report directly to me." That means that he bypassed a whole lot of interim officers. And he said, "You report every 10 days." And it was usually by written report on what you've been doing. And in a sense, what he was saying to Earl is, and I've got your back.
Yeah.
Whenever you know, if you do encounter trouble, and Earl and his successor really did, Canby stepped in, and in one case the scouts were actually in a Union stockade, mm-hmm. and Canby stepped in, and I found the document, and all it says on the document, their incarceration was released by order of the commanding general. So get back on the river, boys. In that case, the funny part of that story is the man who was holding them was in Vicksburg. His name was C.C. Washburn. He went on to become governor of Wisconsin later, but for that moment, he was outranked.
Well, I'll tell you what, there were people from both the North and the South that were not happy with Isaac Earle.
Absolutely, absolutely. There were a lot of folks by 1864 who wanted to get about the business of being in business. They wanted to get at that Confederate cotton. The United States government, the Congress, had established rules for trade with areas that formerly in insurrection. Well, problem with that is it's not hard to smuggle things from beyond the area formerly in insurrection into that area. And so there was a lot of smuggling going on. And there were, as the Union Army seized plantations along the river, they were then in turn leased out again to grow cotton and ship it north. So there was, it was a real gray area over what was fair trade or permitted trade and what wasn't. And Isaac Earle's idea was to, and he did it constantly, he would first raid, seize, and then he'd sort it out.
After the fact.
He would arrest, and he did arrest somewhere, by my count, at least 200, probably more than that, Southerners for engaging in guerrilla activities, engaging in smuggling of all sorts. As I said, he'd seize, arrest, turn them all over to the provost marshal and let them figure it out.
Yeah, and there were, you might even give us a story or two of what happened on one of his experiences or one of his raids, because I thought that all those were really interesting. I mean, people, they even caught groups that, or at least in one case I remember, people coming up to the steamboat. They didn't realize it was run by the Northerners, and they were Southerners that got arrested right at the boat.
That's right. That happened in St. Joseph. They scouts had been let off further north. They had ridden into the back country, and the steamboat then made its way back and docked at St. Joseph to wait for them. And while they were out capturing, in that case, wagon loads of wool and about 20-some prisoners, as I remember, a few guys around St. Joseph saw this new boat, which had no markings indicating it was Union property, and the crew was not in uniform of any kind. So these guys rode up to the boat and were immediately arrested. you know, it's under, oh, ooh, this is not going to end well.
Talking today with Gordon Olson. Gordon is the author of The Notorious Isaac Earle and His Scouts, Union Soldiers, Prisoners, and Spies. Having a lot of fun talking with him. You can join in, too, if you have a question about the war and about Wisconsin. Maybe you've heard of Isaac Earle and his scouts, maybe not. Are you familiar with what went on the Western Front of the Civil War? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or if you'd like, you could post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post your questions or your comments there. Now, I talked a little bit about Jane O'Neill.
Yes.
Talk about her, and then about her how they got together.
Well, that's a great story. She and her family lived on a farm just east of Baton Rouge. I don't know, maybe a dozen miles, maybe not even that far as I recall, but just outside of Baton Rouge. And they were not ardent Confederates, although her brother served in the Confederate Army. And Earl was leading a group in the area and rode past the O'Neill farm and noticed a bunch of chickens running around in the yard of the farm. And he was used to seizing contraband whenever it seemed to suit his purpose, and so he decided those chickens were contraband and that they would make a great dinner for his scouts. And so he rides up into the yard, and they start grabbing chickens, and Jane O'Neill comes out of the house and gives him what for. And the interesting part of the story, as the O'Neill family tells it, he backed off for whatever reason. Now, his scouts would say because he was a gentleman. Others might say that he was intimidated by this feisty woman. But in any case, the chickens stayed, but a relationship was started. She ultimately provided information. Her father had been killed by outlaws, and so there's no doubt that she did not have a great deal of love and respect for the guerrillas in the area, and passed on information that Earl used. They began to see each other. I don't have the details. Boy, what I wouldn't give for a set of letters if they had exchanged them. I had to piece it together as best I could. But without a doubt, by the end of November, or November, I should say the beginning of November, end of October of 1864, they were married in Natchez, Mississippi. I think he spent one night, they spent the first night together, and then he was back out on the river with the scouts. They were married, but he was not home a lot.
No, he certainly wasn't. And he, I want to get back to that in a bit. But the other, now here's a guy who, I mean, just what was he doing before this? I mean, he was a young guy. What was he, 24?
No, he wasn't even that old.
He was 24.
At the beginning of the war, he was 21.
21 years old. So
probably could write his name. But other than that, I don't think he was literate. He had a niece, a cousin, who went on to be a teacher. So I think he may have gotten a bit of schooling before. But nothing I've seen indicates that he could write anything beyond his name. And at least one of the scouts said as much, that he was schooled in the ways of the woods. He worked in lumber camps in the winter and on a farm in the summer for his uncle. His parents died when he was 10. And he's one of these guys, there's nothing to indicate that this is a great soldier waiting to be discovered. But thrust into war, into the all of the things that go on in a wartime environment, he emerges as not only a brave and courageous soldier, but as a very good leader. And that's his story. To me, the most fascinating thing is out of nowhere comes this really remarkable leader.
And the people, the guys that were under him were similarly, I mean, they weren't really professional military types. They were all Wisconsin guys that, were thrust into it.
Bunch of Wisconsin farm boys. They come from all over the state. They had formed in these little militia companies. Eight of them are from St. Croix County and that area. They were the Hudson Guards. Others from Wisconsin Dells area, one from Oconto, a couple from Sheboygan Falls. They were not from the Madison-Milwaukee area. They were from all of the small towns of Wisconsin. There's a wonderful story. Before the Scouts were formed, they were all part of the 4th Wisconsin, and they were tired of walking. They'd been marching a lot. And so they unilaterally decided they would become mounted infantry. And they went out and acquired enough horses so that they were the whole 4th Wisconsin was mounted infantry. And as they put it, they looked a little unusual. There were tall men on short horses and short men on tall horses, men on beautiful horses with a mule pack for a saddle and vice versa. Mm-hmm. One man with a side saddle is the best he could come up with, but they were all mounted, and they were determined to show and successfully show that these Wisconsin boys knew how to handle horses and could ride, and that's what they did for the rest of the war.
And really, Earl, I mean, I think there were plots just to murder him.
There were. There definitely were. He was so well known. He was the notorious Isaac Earl. Those are not my words. Those come out of a newspaper in the South. Larry, one of the really exciting things for me was I let this story go for a long time, and when I went back to it, the technology had changed dramatically, and all of a sudden, I could search the newspapers of the South and the North for keywords.
Oh, sure.
Like Isaac Earl, and I found stories of him in the Louisville paper, the New Orleans papers, the Nashville paper, the New York Times carried several stories about his exploits. Mm-hmm. None of that did I know first time around. I didn't have time to sit and read all those newspapers, if I could find them. So it really became an important story of the evolution of historical research, as well as the story of these guys and their exploits.
Well, I'm telling you, this was absolutely a fascinating book for me, and I know our listeners, many of them, are going to be taking a look at your book and enjoying it as much as I did. Gordon, thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
I'm certainly glad I read your book carefully. And the book is The Notorious Isaac Earl and His Scouts, Union Soldiers, Prisoners, and Spies. And again, the author, Gordon Olson, that's O-L-S-O-N, not E-N, O-L-S-O-N, The Notorious Isaac Earl and His Scouts. Read it. I think you're going to enjoy it. And thanks a lot for listening, and please do stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We have shared the incommunicable experience of war. We have felt, we still feel, the passion of life to its top. In our youths, our hearts were touched with fire. Oliver Wendell Holmes.